Mormonism 101 for Teens is a valuable resource for anyone wanting a simplified view of the Mormon religion from a Christian perspective. Mormonism 101 for Teens is available at the Utah Lighthouse Bookstore in Salt Lake City or mrm.org. Viewpoint on Mormonism, the program that examines the teachings of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a biblical perspective. Viewpoint on Mormonism is sponsored by Mormonism Research Ministry. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has been dedicated to equipping the body of Christ with answers regarding the Christian faith in a manner that expresses gentleness and respect. And now, your host for today's Viewpoint on Mormonism.
Welcome to this edition of Viewpoint on Mormonism. I'm your host, Bill McKeever, founder and director of Mormonism Research Ministry. And with me today is Eric Johnson, my colleague at MRM. Today we are looking at Chapter 3 in a history book titled Saints, the Standard of Truth, published by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 2018. And as we mentioned, we don't plan on going through every single chapter, and nor is this supposed to be an exhaustive study of this history book. But there is a lot of information in it that I think is very important that we need to know if we're going to have a fruitful conversation with our LDS acquaintances. Today, as I said, we're going to be looking at Chapter 3, titled Plates of Gold. What does it say, starting on page 21, Eric?
One day, while Joseph was helping a neighbor dig a well, he came across a small stone buried deep in the earth. Aware that people sometimes use special stones to search for lost objects or hidden treasure, Joseph wondered if he had found such a stone. Looking into it, he saw things invisible to the natural eye.
Now, here we have an example of the church, I would say, being much more transparent than it has been in the past. It wasn't too terribly long ago when the church came right out and talked about the seer stone. There was a picture of Joseph Smith's seer stone in one of the local newspapers. And even though they don't have the seer stone on display at the Church History Museum across from Temple Square, they do have a photograph of that stone in one of the displays talking about the seer stone and how Joseph Smith used it to translate the Book of Mormon.
Well, that caused great consternation for many Latter-day Saints who had always believed, as far as the translation of the Book of Mormon was concerned, that Joseph Smith had the plates, that he actually was able to read them. And that was the movies that the church would produce, also the Ensign magazine. In 2001, there was an Ensign magazine front cover of Joseph Smith doing that. But what's fascinating, they changed their view as far as publicly showing the Latter-day Saints what was believed about the seer stone. And in December of 2017, in the Ensign magazine, there is a picture in one of the articles, and it has Joseph Smith taking a look at, well, he had just looked at the hat with the seer stone there, and the plates are covered up, and he's giving Oliver Cowdery the translation. That's the first time in history we've ever seen any church art portray it the way that it really did take place.
Yeah, you would think that if Joseph Smith needed gold plates to give us the Book of Mormon, he would be somehow looking at the plates and translating from the characters that were allegedly on these plates. But yet, if he's looking at a rock in a hat, he certainly can't be looking at the plates. You wonder how many Latter-day Saints have put two and two together and realized there's a real flaw in this story. Why did he need to go get the plates if he didn't have to look at them at all?
And it was amazing that in that art, they do have the plates covered. So there's not even a way for him to look at the plates if he's looking at the hat. The next paragraph on page 21 reads, Joseph's gift for using the stone impressed family members who saw it as a sign of divine favor. But even though he had the gift of a seer, Joseph was still unsure if God was pleased with him. He could no longer feel the forgiveness and peace he had felt after his vision of the Father and Son. Instead, he often felt condemned for his weakness and imperfections.
Now, this isn't the first time it brings this up. If you look just across the page, on page 20, it says that Joseph found that being forgiven once did not mean he would never need to repent again. And then at the bottom of page 21, it says that Joseph began to pray, pleading fervently that God would forgive his sins. Does it seem like to you, Eric, Joseph Smith has a real problem knowing whether or not his sins are forgiven? It sounds like a lot of modern Latter-day Saints, they don't know if their sins are forgiven, and Joseph Smith seems to have the same problem. The reason why I think that's worthy of note is because in a previous show, we were talking about this idea of Joseph Smith seeing God the Father And I mentioned how in the book of Exodus, in the Joseph Smith translation, Smith adds a number of words to Exodus 33:20, where he makes it very clear that no sinful man is going to be able to see God and live. I want to read that from Exodus 33:20, from the Inspired Version or the Joseph Smith translation. This is how it reads, "And he said unto Moses, Thou canst not see my face at this time, lest mine anger is kindled against thee also, and I destroy thee and thy people. For there shall no man among them see me at this time and live, and they are exceeding sinful. And no sinful man hath at any time, neither shall there be any sinful man at any time that shall see my face and live." Now, we know that Joseph Smith obviously had to be a sinful human being, because even in this book, though it conflates the stories of the first vision with Joseph Smith's various accounts, in his 1832 account, he said that he sees Jesus, the one who was crucified for him, and this Jesus says that his sins are forgiven. So obviously he had to be a sinful human being in order to have his sins forgiven. Now they conflate the 1832 account and they put it into this account, combining it with the 1838 account where now God the Father shows up as well. And again, the story is that Joseph Smith had his sins forgiven. If he was a sinful man, how did he see the face of God and live to tell about it? I think that's a fair question. But it makes me also wonder, why would Joseph Smith put this in his Joseph Smith translation? Doesn't that seem a little bit dangerous, Eric, that he would say something like this if he had already had this experience seeing God the Father in Jesus in the spring of 1820? Because he doesn't come out with this Bible version, this Joseph Smith translation, until after 1833. That's when he claimed he finished it.
You said something very important in there, he, and you said that why did he put this in? And the point is that Exodus 33, as retranslated by Joseph Smith, is not found in any of the ancient manuscripts. The Dead Sea Scrolls do not have that. Nobody has that. It's something that Joseph Smith had to come up with. So why did he create that, you're asking? And that's a great question.
I think the answer is very simple, folks. It's because he was not saying at this time that he had ever been visited by God the Father. It would seem to make no sense at all to word Exodus 33:20 the way Joseph Smith does in that passage if he had already seen the face of God and lives. He wasn't telling the story, and that's the whole point. Nobody knew about that first vision. Yet Joseph Smith is lying to people by saying later on that he was persecuted for this alleged first vision, and it even brings it out in this history book. Smith lied about that. He was not being persecuted for that. He was being persecuted for claiming he was visited by an angel in 1823 who told him about the Book of Mormon, but we have no record of people specifically mentioning Joseph Smith being persecuted because he had an encounter with God the Father in Jesus. That is an argument from silence. Now, in this chapter, Plates of Gold, he has this visitation by the angel Moroni. What does it say on page 22?
At first, Joseph was afraid, but peace soon filled him. The angel called him by name and introduced himself as Moroni. He said God had forgiven Joseph of his sins and now had work for him to do. He declared that Joseph's name would be spoken of for good and evil among all people. Moroni spoke of gold plates buried in a nearby hill. On their plates was etched the record of an ancient people who once lived in the Americas. The record told of their origins and gave an account of Jesus Christ visiting them and teaching the fullness of his gospel. Buried with the plates, Moroni said, were two seer stones, which Joseph later called the Urim and Thummim, or interpreters. The Lord had prepared these stones to help Joseph translate the record. The clear stones were fastened together and attached to a breastplate.
Now let's talk about this for a bit, because when he's visited by the angel who calls himself Moroni, he speaks of gold plates. Now later on in the book, it's going to backpedal a little bit on what the plates were actually composed of. But here we have clearly Moroni spoke of gold plates buried in a nearby hill. On the plates was etched the record of an ancient people who once lived in the Americas. Now, that sounds to me, Eric, would you agree, that it's supposed to be a record of real people who lived in real places and were involved in real events? In other words, the Book of Mormon, as it's going to come to be known, is a story about real history.
When it says ancient people, is exactly what you're talking about. This is not Lord of the Rings kind of people. These are real people if they're ancient people.
And it says it's going to tell about their origins. And of course, the origins of these people traces back to the Middle East. And that has become problematic for the LDS Church because the descendants of these ancient people, Mormon leaders have said, are the American Indians, whose heritage do not go back to the Middle East. There's a problem, and that's caused a lot of individuals to doubt the Joseph Smith story or Joseph Smith's claim regarding the Book of Mormon. So he goes on to say that before departing, the angel commanded Joseph to take care of the plates, show them to no one unless otherwise instructed, and then he departs. Now, Joseph Smith is going to be allowed to eventually retrieve the gold plates. And here we find on page 25 that Joseph Smith sets out immediately for the hill where the angel said the plates were deposited. And during the night, Moroni had showed him a vision of where the plates were hidden, so he knew where to go. The hill, one of the biggest in the area, was about 3 miles from his house. That would make sense if you were to just go on Google Maps and start where the Joseph Smith cabin is, the recreated cabin that they have to this day, and then go to the monument where Smith allegedly retrieved the plates. It's about 3 miles away. So you have to figure that Joseph Smith is going to carry these plates for a distance of about 3 miles to get to his home. The book often talks about the value of the plates, and it does so on page 25. What does it say about the value of the plates?
It says the plates were valuable not because they were gold, but because they witnessed of Jesus Christ.
But again, the metal that's being described seems to be the metal gold. And the reason I bring that up is because there's been a lot of excuse making on the part of Latter-day apologists to try and make it sound like the plates were really not made of gold, but probably a lighter alloy. But it talks about the worth of the plates. If you go right over page 26, top of the first paragraph, astonished, Joseph wondered again how much the plates were worth. If they were merely made of copper, probably not a whole lot.
Bill, I found interesting on the top of page 27, when Joseph supposedly asked when he could have the plates, and he was told the 22nd day of September next, if you bring the right person with you. Who is the right person, Joseph asked? Your older brother. Now it's talking about his brother, Alvin.
And of course, Alvin would die within that next year. Why is it that this angel, who's sent by, we assume, an omniscient God, doesn't know that Alvin is going to die before that next year is up?
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information regarding Mormonism Research Ministry, we encourage you to visit our website at www.mrm.org, where you can request our free newsletter, Mormonism Researched. We hope you will join us again as we look at another viewpoint on Mormonism.